From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie, and welcome to America's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM. Well, those Friday night, Saturday morning open lines next hour. Get ready for that. Here's some quick stories of the day. The beloved American robin, the bird, not the annoying crow, may be the more potent source now for West Nile virus, according to new research. A DNA analysis of blood taken from the abdomens of 300 mosquitoes trapped in Connecticut over the past 3 years found that 40% fed on the blood of the red-breasted songbird, the robin, and only 1% on crows, according to a chief medical at Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station. It was quite surprising, he said. For a while, they thought robins did not play a major role in West Nile virus. They're now rethinking all that. Look into the skies, but look very, very carefully, because the sun has made a big turn. As expected, a big sunspot group emerged over the sun's eastern limb on today, its very active region producing frequent solar flares and coronal mass ejections. They say that the percent of an X flare, 15%. Now, Sunday, Ed Dames will be Art Bell's first hour guest. Could this be the kill shot that Ed Dames was talking about? And the big news today, astronomers have announced that they have discovered a new planet larger than Pluto in orbit around the sun, likely renewing debate now over what exactly is a planet and whether Pluto should keep its status as one. The planet, the farthest known object in the solar system, is currently 9 billion miles away from the sun, or about three times Pluto's current distance from the sun. This is the first object to be confirmed to be larger than Pluto in the outer solar system, according to Michael Brown, a scientist at the California Institute of Technology. He labeled the project as the 10th planet, but there are some scientists who dispute the classification of Pluto as such. Astronomers do not know the new planet's exact size, but its brightness shows that it is at least as large as Pluto and could be up to 1.5 times bigger. The research was funded by NASA. Now, Brown has submitted a name for the new planet, but he has not released what the proposed name is. In a moment, our guest will be Philip Plait. He calls himself the Bad Astronomer on Coast to Coast AM. And Philip Plait works at the Physics and Astronomy Department at Sonoma State University, which is part of the California State University system. Currently, he is working on a NASA-sponsored public outreach program for a satellite named GLAST, Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. And previously, Plait worked at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center on the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph. He received his Ph.D. in astronomy at the University of Virginia. That was in 1994, nicknamed the Bad Astronomer. One of his missions is to clear up misconceptions about astronomy, which he does through his website, badastronomy.com. Philip will be with us this half hour, then rushing off to go visit a telescope to look at what could very well be now another new planet in the solar system. Philip, how are you?
Hi, George. Doing pretty well.
Now, remember many, many, many months ago, we were on the show, and I said, hey, Phil, is there another planet in the solar system? And you said, probably not.
Well, I said probably not. Now, regular listeners might remember I've been on before talking about Planet X.
You're on a lot.
And saying, you know, there's no such thing as some giant planet that's going to come in and kill us all.
That's true.
But there might be other objects bigger than Pluto outside of Pluto's orbit that could be out there. And they would be hard to find because they'd be very dim and moving very slowly. And in fact, many years ago when I worked on Hubble, we had actually looked into looking for something like that, not with Hubble, but with something else. And now it looks like, although that never got off the ground, so to speak, other people who are looking for these objects out beyond Pluto, they've done it. They've dug up some treasure.
Now, are we talking about this one object that's been spotted, or was there another one over the last day or two?
This is one of those stories that's really funny. I actually read a mailing list for Minor Planets. It's on Yahoo Groups. It's called Minor Planets Mailing List.
All right.
And I read it every lunch to see what's going on. And yesterday there wasn't much happening, so I didn't worry about it. Come in this morning, and there are 100 posts on there. A guy in Spain says he has discovered a large object beyond Pluto. It was actually seen in an old image taken in 2003. And so it's got the name 2003 EL61. It's just how they name these things.
Sure.
By observing it over a certain amount of time and you watch this thing move, you can calculate how far away it is. You actually basically plot the orbit. And that's what they did, and they got a distance of this thing being 50 times farther from the sun than the Earth is. Now, this puts it comfortably farther away than Pluto. Now, they know how bright this thing is, and they know how far away it is. By guessing how dark it is, you kind of know how dark these things are. Something darker has to be bigger to be as bright as something which is brighter. You know, a snowball versus a lump of tar will, you know, the lump of tar will be much darker. So to have it reflect as much light as a snowball, it has to be much bigger. And that's literally true here. Most of these objects beyond Pluto are very dark. So you can guess at how dark it is. You can guess how big it is. And the number they got is big. It's about 1,000 miles across. Now, that's not much smaller than Pluto. And they announced this basically yesterday. Well, the plot thickens. Some other guys said, well, we saw this thing as well about a year ago. We just haven't talked about it. Well, that's fine. And they said, but also, well, we found this other object. And this one's called 2003 UB313. Pardon me, my microphone's popping here a little bit.
No, sorry.
This one is almost 100 times as far from the sun as the Earth is. That would put it, 93 million times 100. That's 9 billion miles out from the sun.
Now, is that the one that they announced today?
Yes.
Okay.
These were both announced basically today in the past 24 hours.
Well, the other story's been buried then, because all across this country, we see the big story about the astronomers finding a new planet. They're not talking about this other object. So we're really talking about two objects within a couple days announced, right?
Actually, we're talking about three.
Another one?
The first object, EL61, the one that's about 1,000 miles across, it's probably smaller than Pluto, though not by much.
Is it a planet, asteroid? What would you categorize it as?
Well, right now, they're just called trans-Neptunian objects. In other words, objects that are beyond Neptune's orbit.
Okay.
Because it's hard to know what these things are. Some of them have funny orbits that make them like Pluto. They might be like giant ice balls, like giant comet nuclei, hundreds of, or even 1,000 miles across. So it's kind of an odd object, and they're not big enough to actually see in a telescope. They just look like a dot of light.
Assuming comets are ice balls.
Well,
that's
I think that's
story.
A fair assumption.
That's
I know you're
story.
Referring to James McCanney.
Yes.
And I, you know, we can talk about him if you'd like, but I don't think that his theories are correct, and I've got a web page showing that. But it's pretty clear that these things are chunks of something that are cold. We'll probably know better in a few years when we send the Pluto Express probe to go by Pluto and take pictures. But in the meantime, back to these objects. This one that's 1,000 miles across and about 5 billion miles out, it appears to have a moon. These other guys observed it. There are two teams here. One's a Spanish team. They use a small telescope. They found and announced this first object, EL61. Then these other guys came out and said, yes, we observed this some time ago. In fact, we have a much bigger telescope. We used the Keck 10-meter telescope in Hawaii, and they've actually been able to see that this thing has a moon. Now, this is important because if you can watch the moon orbit the object, you can get the mass of the object using basically math by Isaac Newton.
Right.
And they figured out that this thing, let's see, if I got the moons right, I think EL61 is the one with the moon. This is all happening so quickly, it's hard to keep up.
It really is an incredible series of stories here, Philip.
And it has 32%. Yes, it is. It's EL61. I've got this written down. It has about a third of the mass of Pluto, and it's about 70% of Pluto's diameter. So it's big. It's just not quite as big as Pluto.
All right, so that's one.
Yes.
One object.
Now, that's the smaller one,
right.
The one that was announced first yesterday.
Okay.
The new one, if you want to call it new, it's you know, a few hours younger, UB313, that's 1,600 miles across. Now, I said that they have to assume how reflective this thing is, if it's dark or bright or whatever, to get its size. Even if they assume this thing is as small as it can possibly be, it is still comfortably bigger than Pluto. If this is confirmed, it has not been confirmed yet about the size. They've got some observations of it. More will be taken. I expect in the next few weeks we'll have everybody pointing their telescope at this thing. If this is confirmed, this object is definitely bigger than Pluto. It is 100 times the Earth's distance from the Sun. It is 9 billion miles out. Pluto is roughly 3 billion miles out, roughly. This thing is way the hell out and gone. It's amazing. It's just amazing. And, you know, I've been expecting this for many years. I've been expecting that we would find brighter, or I should say bigger objects than Pluto. It's just been a matter of time. I say that because we now know of well over 100 of these giant ice balls out there, and it just looks like Pluto's the biggest. But we found a couple of other ones. You might remember Sedna,
yes,
and Kwalwar, these weirdly named,
right,
objects.
They're out there, too.
They're out there, too, and they're half as big as Pluto, and, you know, it just seemed like it's a matter of time.
Okay, now this most recent one, then, number three, I would guess, right?
Well, I'm saying it's three objects because one of them has a moon.
One, the moon. Okay.
So EL-16 is a double, and okay. UB-313 is a single.
Okay, so the one that was basically announced today.
Yes.
Could you say that that is Planet X at this point?
Well, the classic definition of Planet X is a 10th planet. If you want to call Pluto a planet and you want to call this a planet, then, hey, look, it's the 10th planet. A lot of people like calling Pluto a planet. I haven't always been, but since we started discovering these objects and it became clear that there were a lot of them, I've started leaning towards the idea that Pluto is just the biggest of these objects, and it's not really a true planet.
Do we know what the orbit is of the planet announced today?
Yes. In fact, I don't know how elliptical it is off the top of my head. I would need to look that up. But I do know that it is tilted with respect to the other planets by about 45 degrees. I think 44 degrees is how much it's tilted.
Well, you know, Zechariah Sitchin says that the Sumerian tablets, when we talk about that extra planet in his book, 12th Planet, says that this planet is on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit, 3,600 years to do its circle. Could that be this one?
Well, no, because Zechariah Sitchin's wrong.
I don't know about that anymore, Phil.
Oh, I do. His claims are that this planet comes in every 3,600 years,
yes,
and comes,
yes,
into the inner solar system.
Right, right.
And that is just physically impossible for a giant planet to get into the inner solar system without disrupting all the orbits of the planets. And we just don't see that. Planets like Venus have an incredibly circular orbit. And so if you want to say that there's some giant planet out there which comes into the inner solar system and disrupts the planets, there must be something keeping Venus from being on a hugely erratic orbit, and the Earth, for that matter, and the Moon, and all of these things. And so I just don't think that these claims of a giant planet sweeping into the inner solar system are correct.
All right, well, this one, though, this one here, I assume they will be able to plot out its orbit?
Yeah, they have. It's not on a hugely elliptical orbit. I think it is somewhat elliptical, but I don't think it's elliptical enough. As a matter of fact, let me think about this. I think I saw a map of the orbit, and the inner region of it gets near Neptune, but it doesn't go any closer in than that. So it couldn't possibly be anything that these other people have predicted.
Why can't these objects just be parts of maybe some larger planet that blew up billions of years ago?
Ah, the Van Flandern theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to be correct for a lot of reasons, one of which is these things are way out, and the orbits just aren't elliptical enough to have been from something that blew up in the inner solar system and blew them out. In fact, the current theory is that these things formed relatively close in to the Sun, and by relatively, I mean pretty much out where, like, Neptune and Pluto are. And the giant planets would sweep them up and toss them out to where they are now over literally millions and billions of years. And so you've got this population of these things out there, and it's like a flattened or a puffy disk, and it's called the Kuiper Belt, and it sort of merges into a cloud, a spherical cloud of objects called the Oort Cloud. These are named after the people who first theorized them. They had no evidence of these things. They were just kind of guessing based on orbits of comets. And then look what happened. You know, we start finding these things, and here they are. And now, you know, these guys have gone out here and they've searched for these things.
How many more planets are we going to find, Philip, in our solar system? I mean, how far out do we go before it's not our solar system anymore?
That's a fair question. It's thought that the Oort cloud goes out about 1 trillion miles, which is about 1/6 of a light year.
Oh, my. Okay.
It's 6 trillion. Yeah, 6 trillion miles to a light year. So it extends pretty far out. If you get too much farther out than that, then stars passing nearby as we orbit the galaxy over millions of years will disrupt these comets. And so you don't expect to see too many more of them. But that's hugely far away compared to this thing. We're talking 100 times the distance of this object that they just discovered. I don't think we're going to find too many more with the present technology much farther than this object, simply because they get so far away and they're so faint, they're really hard to see. And this one has its orbit tilted so much that it was in a part of the sky where people weren't expecting to find anything like this. So it's pretty exciting that they found it.
How then could something like this form so far out during the formation of the universe, the formation of our solar system? One would assume if they're part of our solar system, they all formed at relatively the same time, right?
Yeah.
How could this material, this dust that began to form our planets, how could it get out there so far? I mean, that's what amazes me.
Well, there are two points I'll make here. One is that, like I said, the current theory is that they formed closer in and they were kicked out here by the gravity of the outer planet.
That's a long way to go.
It is a long way. That is absolutely correct. But we do see disks around other stars. I worked on several projects on Hubble to look at these young stars that still have a disk of dust around them forming planets. And we would see gaps in these disks and odd structures in the disks that look like there are forming planets in these things that are sweeping out a gap, almost looking like Saturn's rings. And sometimes these gaps were way out, farther out from the star than even this object is. So it's quite possible in some of these, now these are bigger stars than the sun, but still, it does seem likely that objects like this could form really far out, much farther out than people previously thought. You know, in an image of a star doing this is worth 1,000 theories. And so we're going to learn, the more of these things that we see, the more objects like UB313 that we find, the more stars that we see with disks around them, and we're going to be finding more as time goes on with better telescopes, the more we'll learn about how these objects can form and how they get out so far.
As an astronomer, are you guys all learning things that are just brand new, things that you never expected before?
Oh, yeah. I'm going nuts here. This is so cool. I'm actually looking at my computer screen right now. We have a telescope. It's a small telescope, a 14-inch scope that is hooked up to a digital camera, and it's observing the position where I think EL61 is right now. We're hoping to get images of it. It's very faint, so we're going to take a lot of images and add them up and see if we can see it. And then we'll go back tomorrow night and Sunday night and Monday night, and we'll keep observing it, and we should see this thing moving very slowly across our image. This is an object, okay, that is 5 billion miles away, 5 billion miles away. It's half the size of the Earth's moon, and yet we can capture this thing with a telescope that you can buy out of the back of a magazine. It's just incredible. I love this stuff.
Well, keep abreast of things, Philip. Badastronomy.com, will you be posting anything unusual on that website?
Well, I actually have a special link. If you go to badastronomy.com, there's a link that says Coast to Coast AM. If you click on it, it'll take you to a page where I've written up basically more or less what I've said here tonight. There's a little more detail, and there are a lot of links there with information on how you can read more about this. It's not every day a 10th planet is discovered.
Hey, you want to be part of a roundtable discussion, but I won't tell you who the other people are yet?
You know, let me see if I'm psychic here. We'll talk.
You're open to talking?
No, I'm just trying to be polite on the air.
Oh, okay. All right, Philip, good luck. Thanks for the updates.
Thank you for having me on, George.
That's Philip Plait, the bad astronomer. He's really not a bad astronomer. He just is a mainstream astronomer. Now, in a moment, We're going to Albuquerque, where Richard C. Hoagland is standing by. He's going to update us on the latest with the space shuttle discovery. We'll get Richard's reaction to this possible new planet. I say possible new planet because until they name it a planet, as far as I'm concerned, it's still a possibility. It's an object, no doubt. We'll get his reaction on that and some other things. And the next hour, open lines, so get ready for that. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Some time ago, we had a CD available for those of you who subscribe to the After Dark newsletter. It was with Father Malachi Martin and Art Bell. Now we have a brand new CD, a new interview called Perfect Possession. When you subscribe to After Dark or renew, call 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505, or also go online, coasttocoastam.com. On the coasttocoastam.com website, under Hot Stories, take a look at the water ice in a crater in the Martian North Pole. What an incredible story. There's a lot of water down there that's turned to ice. There are images taken by the European spacecraft's Mars Express show a patch of water of ice sitting on the floor of an unnamed crater near the Martian North Pole. Just when you get a moment, go up there and take a look on the coasttocoastam.com website. It is an amazing picture. The Space Shuttle Discovery's commander has said her crew is surprised and disappointed that the foam debris problem still exists. A similar scenario of falling foam during liftoff caused the Columbia shuttle disaster in 2003. Commander Eileen Collins told journalists she believes NASA would fix the problem and that Discovery would return safely. Officials expect to be able to give the shuttle the all clear by Sunday. On Friday, Discovery's crew conducted a close survey of the shuttle's thermal heat shield to see if it had suffered damage during Tuesday's liftoff. Foam debris came away during the launch, prompting NASA to suspend flights after Discovery's return on August 7th. In a moment, our guest, science advisor, and from the enterprisemission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, about the shuttle and this other new planetary, quote-unquote, find. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Richard C. Hoagland, enterprisemission.com, Coast to Coast AM science advisor, our guest. Richard, is it my imagination, or are we having a lot of space news over the last couple of weeks? You've been on this program more than I have.
No, that's only when you start taking vacations.
Oh, man, this is incredible, all these things that are going on.
Well, I don't think it's accidental. The last 24 hours on this new planet stuff is an example of astronomy when it works best. What our friend Phil didn't tell you is that these observations, these announcements, are good old competition. You had the Spanish team who had been tracking this thing out there for like almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. Then you had the Caltech team that saw the Spanish team publish yesterday, and they said, oh my God, we've got to get out there with our discovery. And so they had a press conference this afternoon, and it's like watching a ping pong match.
That tells me you can't sit on this data too long.
You can if you own all of it. The cool part about ground-based astronomy is that you've got real competing teams. It's real democracy. The problem with NASA, the question, of course, you didn't ask, Phil, is where's the deep impact data? Isn't it interesting?
I didn't have time to ask him that.
Oh, come on. We had $333 million spent to go and tap on one of these things and find out what it's made of. And, I mean, this is like trying to get into, George Bush's secret closet to find out if he's the one who called Robert Novak about Valerie Plame. It's like a huge national state secret, what is Temple One made of, yet we've got teams on the ground looking with telescopes that are telling us that there's new additions to the solar system, and you get the news the way you're supposed to get the news. What's wrong with this picture?
Okay, we'll come back to that in a second. Here okay. We have, though, we've got some astronauts up in space. They're planning to come down on August 7th, the night we're going to have a special shuttle show.
Well, I got news for you there.
They're not coming down?
They're not coming down. Remember on this show a couple days ago I told you that they were going to stay longer?
Now, that's not been announced yet.
It will be tomorrow.
All right. Okay. Okay.
At the afternoon post-mission management team press briefing, Wayne Hale, who is the deputy program manager for NASA headquarters for the shuttle, almost announced it. He said, he said the station has asked, we're in the meetings looking, you know, and of course they're going to respond affirmatively, because the reason they're going to stay the day longer is to transfer more supplies from Discovery to the station and bring more trash from the station,
yes,
back to Earth with Discovery, because we don't know at this moment tonight when the next shuttle mission will visit the space station. But,
and we can't keep relying on the Russians.
Well, think of it this way. It's not a matter we can't keep relying. It's that the Russians don't have the technology we do to resupply the station. Let me give you a number. It turns out that we've got this Rafael module that was taken up. It's basically a huge, you know, trash container.
Mm-hmm.
And you take it up full of all kinds of goodies, 15 tons of goodies, from water to electronic parts to new laptops, you know, everything you can imagine that they've needed that they haven't been able to get for 2.5 years.
Right.
They then unload all the trash, defined as the stuff they don't need anymore, the stuff that broke that they want to come back and look at and see what went wrong so they can fix it so it doesn't go wrong next time. That's about 13 tons. It turns out that that Rafael module, that 15 tons of stuff, goodies that we took up in Discovery, is equivalent to 7 Progress resupply flights from the Russians.
Oh, my gosh. That's,
so you
that
can
a
see
lot.
The disparity,
yeah,
in how much we can deliver with one shuttle.
And 7 shuttle flights over the normal course of launches, you're talking at least 2 or 3 years.
At least 2 years, yeah. So, you know, this is why you need the shuttle system working to finish the station and to get on with the vision of exploring the back to the moon and then on to Mars. I have good news tonight and other news.
All right. What's the good news?
The good news is I can be absolutely confident the astronauts are in total good shape. They're going to come home, you know, the day later. There's really nothing wrong with the shuttle. We've looked at all the pictures. They've looked at all the pictures. They have this amazing laser scanner that I spent all one night looking at all the data coming down the other night.
So we should have a normal reentry.
We will have a normal reentry. This is probably a cleaner shuttle than we've had in a long time, and we know so much more now than we've known about any other shuttle mission returning or going, and I'm going to do a whole blog on why that is and why it's also curious. If you go to Enterprise Mission and look at the new captain's blog, there's a whole listing there of things that I've been talking about in terms of not only Deep Impact, but the shuttle mission, and some of the interesting things that don't quite make sense and don't quite fit. But the good news is they are going to be coming home safely. It's going to just be one day later. Now, I don't know what that does. It probably shouldn't do anything to our planned show, because we're not going to really talk about just the shuttle. I want to talk about, where do we go from here?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I wanted to talk about the fact that they had landed, but if they haven't landed that day, all right, so
yeah,
what?
Yeah, we need to talk about, what do we have that's different than rockets, more reliable than tiles, and more in the vision of Star Trek. I mean, last night I was really chafing at the bit to ask Walter some of his thoughts about, further thoughts about what he thought when he saw the Enterprise rolled out and the fact that we're still flying this same kind of ship a generation later. You know, I'm sure that when he and Gene and the others were there on that runway watching Enterprise come out of the hangar, that they never imagined that he'd be on the air 20 years later and there'd be a shuttle flying.
Exactly. The foam that basically glanced the shuttle this time and caused the disaster with the Columbia 2.5 years ago. If these things have occurred now on the last two launches, I'm assuming we've had foam problems for a long, long time and just either never said anything about it or we never knew it.
Well, what appears to have happened in the blog is very interesting, because I have a huge intelligent network of very bright people all over the world who are sending me data. I had a guy send me tonight a link, which I went and read on the NASA website, showing that they were tracking problems with foam suddenly coming off in larger amounts than they could feel comfortable with. As far back as 1997, STS-87, the STS stands for NASA's name for the shuttle program, mm-hmm, the Space Transportation System. STS-87, unfortunately, was the Columbia. When she came back from that flight, which was, I think, in February of 97, she had something like 350 gouges in the tiles. 350.
Yes.
Some of them were 2.5 inches deep. Now, they didn't find these until she landed and stopped the rollout, and they could come up under her and take a look, you know, at the tile.
Were they in shock with the kind of
they
damage?
They were really unhappy because, I mean, this was over, way over what they'd ever seen before. It turns out that around that time frame, they changed the way they put the foam on the big external tank. They had been using a certain chemical process that apparently adhered the foam really well to the tank, so they didn't have all these dings. And when they made the switch, which was from a Freon-based system, because this stuff basically comes out of, you know, the nozzles like whipped cream.
Right.
You have to push it out with some kind of gas.
Yeah.
And they used Freon. NASA, because they were trying to be environmentally compatible with the EPA, switched to a non-Freon type gas for the foam, and apparently, judging by the record that I've looked at tonight, that switch is what began to cause foam to come off.
Interesting.
What I don't understand, since they were tracking this in these memos that I read just tonight on a NASA website that's still there, and it's up on the blog. If you go into the comments section of the Enterprise weblog, you'll find it toward the very end of the posts. They seem not to have done anything. It's like they didn't switch back. So that's a real mystery, given that we've now, you know, killed 7 astronauts because of this foam problem, and we almost killed these guys. If you watch that video, that big piece of foam just missed by a few inches that left-hand wing. Why in the world didn't they switch back to a foam system that stuck to the tank?
And they should. They should.
And they should. Now, this is one of those things that I'm hoping, as we have this national debate, with the fleet grounded again, and the problem with the so-called PAL ramp and all that, I'm hoping that somebody in a position of responsibility says, guys, what happened to the chemistry of the foam? Couldn't we maybe switch back? And if you want to be environmentally friendly, NASA stop using Freon somewhere else so that you kind of balance your Freon budget if somebody is really going to be kind of antsy about that?
If you were running NASA, as I had recommended many moments ago, would you have made this change immediately, as soon as you realized what was wrong?
Absolutely, because we've got the data. It's on the NASA website. They went through very carefully all the things that could have happened to make the foam start to come off. And the one they were left with is, well, we changed the chemistry of the application. So why not change it back? This just seems like common sense. Or maybe it's asking too much of this space agency to deal in common sense, like putting data out there when you get it. You know, little things like that.
And speaking of data, then, where is the data from Deep Impact?
I have no idea. Well, actually, I know exactly where it is. It's hiding in Michael Ahern's computers at the University of Maryland. It's hiding at JPL and those computers. It simply is not on the web and in the national computers of the people who paid $333 million for the data.
Is there that much of a revelation with the information that they can't tell us what the heck they're able to decipher?
Well, you know, George, we are 2 nights shy of an entire month, 4 whole weeks, a whole month. We had all this big flash and fury, pun intended, and then nothing. And, of course, the national press attention is now totally on, you know, Discover and on the grounded shuttle program, what's wrong with the foam.
And now this new planet.
Space, and when they're going to land, and no one is asking except us, where's our damn data? Why can't we see it now? You know that I've said on this show that we think we know what it is they're hiding.
Right.
I am working on preparing a very elaborately documented piece for Enterprise. I will then put a smaller piece pointing to the bigger piece in our blog.
Will it be ready by August 7th?
I cannot promise.
All right.
Because it's like one of those things where you got to do it right. You only get one shot.
I understand. When it's ready, it's ready.
When it's ready, it's ready. But everybody who knows what I do and how we work here knows that we don't put up anything. You know, as Orson Welles used to say, make no wine before it's time. It'll be done when it's done, and when it's done, we'll come out and talk about it, and we'll stand behind it, and then the you-know-what will hit the rotating receptacle.
Let me ask you something. You know the name Nancy Leader. You've heard it before.
Yes, of course.
Okay. She claimed that there was a Planet X. It's going to come rolling around May of a couple of years ago. It didn't happen. She came on the program. She said that it was going to happen in June. It didn't happen, and she basically faded away. Well, we called her today to get a reaction to this new planet that they found, and She's going to be on the program in the not-too-distant future after a two-year hiatus. But this discovery of this planet, even though it may not be Planet X, it does tell me there are a lot of things in the universe and in our solar system specifically that astronomers have no idea about. Because, again, when I talked to Philip just a few moments ago, Philip Plait, he did say on this show that he did not believe that there were that there was another big planet in the solar system.
Well, you know, Alan Stern, who was one of his colleagues in the planetary science community, has predicted as far back as 2 years ago that there could be objects as big as Mars hiding in the outer solar system. You know, it reminds me of that line when, you know, Kirk and Spock are down on a planet and they got McCoy with them, and Scotty, James Doohan, is left in charge of the Enterprise, and they've been lured, you know, across the galaxy, and Scotty's trying to get the Enterprise back to where he can rescue his friends, and Uhura turns to him and she says, "But Mr. Scott, where will we look? It's a big galaxy, Mr. Scott."
Hey, by the way,
big solar system.
Some NASA insiders have just emailed me, if they are, and they say that the government and NASA are exempt from any kind of EPA freon type laws, that they can do whatever they want.
That's an important point, if that's actually true. I mean, look, you know,
maybe it's an image thing that they did.
You know, the government agencies get exemptions all the time.
Right.
If this is killing people and killing the program and putting a glass ceiling on the vision, you know, I mean, the thing that makes this shuttle mission different is this isn't just a mission going to the station, all right? It's now a mission about going wherever we want to go. Yes, we're using the shuttle technology and it's 20 years old. It really should function pretty well. It functioned well enough up until Challenger that we had flights that succeeded and didn't wind up killing people. It should have continued to function as we get more data. We shouldn't be finding more problems. We should be finding fewer problems. What's wrong with this learning curve?
Quick question. I don't know if you saw the picture. You probably did, about the water ice in the crater.
Yes. Yeah, that's an old story, by the way.
Okay, but tell me something. How did the water get in the crater?
Because Mars is loaded with water. Okay.
But,
that's a big secret.
But they just said last week that it's been too cold to have water.
Remember I called them turkeys?
Yes, you did.
I will reiterate. They were turkeys. Anyway.
This is a huge crater. There's a lot of water down there.
There's a lot of water on Mars. It's, some of it's thawed. You know, my friends Jill England and Mr. Palermo, mapping those seeps at our behest, found a stunning sequence on the equator of water leaking out of Mars now in these two polar areas that led to our tidal model. You know, it's really a shame that Phil is so afraid to basically have an open discussion with me, because we could have a really edifying, fun-filled evening.
Absolutely.
Where we laid out alternative models, alternative ideas, how they can be tested, how they can be real science, how NASA doesn't have a lock on truth, justice, or the American way, like some people will have you believe they do. And this whole shuttle problem is just an example. I mean, think about this tonight. In an area, folks, where lives are at stake, where it's supposed to have been the supreme priority to keep people at harm's length, to keep harm out of their way, to make sure they got to orbit safely and could come back, the fact that we came within a whisker of killing them again after $1 billion in 2.5 years, what's wrong with this picture? And if NASA can be so incompetent as to send these people up in a system that isn't ready yet after this hiatus, how do you think they handle things where people's lives are not at stake, where it's just scientific data and no one really cares?
That's Richard C. Hoagland. Rita's blog on theenterprisemission.com. Did you get the email that I forwarded you about a half hour ago about your Godman and E.T. DVD series?
No.
Somebody sent me just a great email about it. Apparently they got it, and they just wanted you to know, and I promised them I would.
So. Well, I thank them, and I tell everybody you should get a copy, because there's some really cool stuff that will become very relevant in the next several months.
To be continued, Richard.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, you take care. You have a good weekend. Say hi to Robin for me. Richard C. Hoagland, science advisor, I'll tell you what, never a dull moment with Richard C. When I come right back, 3 hours of Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. We'll open up a special hotline. There is a reason for that, too. We've got some quick updates coming in. Also, there is a young man who is blind who plays video games. I'm going to talk with him for just a few moments, too. This is an astounding story. I'm George Norrie, and thanks for joining me. Stand by for more Coast to Coast AM.